Welcome to Better Cybersecurity, the ISF podcast. I'm your host, Steve Durbin.
ISF CEO Steve Durbin is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. In today's episode, Steve sits down with Tom Harden, aka Tipper X, best known for helping expose a massive Wall Street insider trading ring. Steve and Tom discuss early warning signs that an organization might be crossing ethical or legal lines, how to build an organizational culture that promotes openness and protects from insider threats, and how to get employees to buy into things like good cyber hygiene.
So today's podcast is a story that reads a little bit like a thriller, but the lessons are actually deeply real. Tom Harden, better known to many as Tipper X, was a young hedge fund analyst who became involved in insider trading during his Wall Street career. Later, he became one of the FBI's most significant cooperators in uncovering financial crime. He's since dedicated his life to helping organizations understand the human side of ethical failure. And today, I'm going to be talking to him about what drives insider behavior, how culture and pressure shape decision-making, and what cybersecurity and risk leaders can actually do and learn about preventing insider threats, not just with technology, but through awareness, ethics, and trust. Your journey from being involved in insider trading to becoming something of an advocate for ethics and compliance is an extraordinary one. Looking back, what were some of the warning signs, both personal and organizational, that created the conditions for insider misconduct in your case?
Yes, in my case, one of the first warning signs was my boss made our goals very short term. So we went from let's make money every 3 years at my hedge fund to after losing money in the first quarter, he came into my office and said, now we have to make money every month or we may not survive. So there was a big change in goal from long term to short term.
So personal pressure from above that kind of
personal pressure to achieve the goal. Now, as the young professional, I didn't ask any clarifying questions as to how to do that. Are we going to stay within the legal or ethical guardrails? Because we were aware of this nefarious behavior happening in our industry. I would encourage young professionals today or anybody, if there's that ambiguous message, make money every month or whatever it is, you have to ask clarifying questions, not to make assumptions.
But that takes quite a lot, doesn't it? You made the point that you're a young professional in that firm. Having, I suppose, the confidence or the ability to be able to raise some of those questions, to question a superior, something that a lot of people just stay well away from. I mean, it's just not worth it at that stage in their career.
You do need to have the psychological safety, which is a bigger buzzword today, but there is truth to that. Am I safe here raising a concern? Because in some countries, there's a big deference to hierarchy where you would never raise a question, you would never speak up. So you do have to be in a more psychologically safe environment to be able to do that. And I didn't feel I was at the time.
And today, when you talk to people, because you spend a lot of time working with the FBI now, don't you, and other organizations, have we actually cracked the code for giving people permission, I suppose, to raise some of those issues in companies?
The biggest paradox out there is every company I speak at has some sort of speak up initiative,
right?
But you don't get people to speak up by telling them to speak up. You actually have to, if you're going to tell them to do that, you have to listen up. So I always encourage leadership to work on their listening skills. If we could just give leaders one skill, I think it would be actually to be better listeners. If we're going to tell people to speak up, we have to at least get back to them on their concern. Thank you for raising it. If they never hear back, or if they say people who speak up, one client told me, people who speak up here disappear. We don't want that type of culture. So I think there's good intent in terms of let's speak up, let's be psychologically safe, but we're not listening up as well as we should be in the companies I engage with.
But at least they're engaging with you.
Yes, that's right.
So that's a start, I guess.
It's a starting point. That's right.
Many cybersecurity breaches today come from within, not necessarily from hackers, but from trusted insiders. So from your own experience, what drives someone inside an organization to cross those ethical or legal lines? You know, is it pressure? Is it opportunity? Is it culture? Is it, what is it?
I think it does come back to the culture. Steve, if you had told me back in university, Tom, a few years from now, this is going to be your story, I would say that would never be me because I'm a good person.
Right.
We all think we're good people. But when you're in the culture, when you're working, when I'm working my first 80-hour weeks at the hedge fund, I'm subsumed by that culture. So that's something I wasn't aware of. I wasn't just as a young professional even thinking about that. But it does often come back to the fraud triangle, the opportunity, the need, and the rationalization. And the biggest one I spoke on today is that rationalization, what goes inside the person's head when they're thinking about crossing the line, what justifications do we tell ourselves, what's that self-talk? So it does often come back so many times in cases to that triangle of the need, the opportunity, and the rationalization. So it can be, in my case, a lax control. I could buy a small stock and not have to talk to my boss. So that was a control that wasn't there. Or we had the need to make money every month, so there was that. So I would encourage people to think about this in terms of that triangle, in terms of why people cross lines inside companies.
I think one of the things that people have said to me that they've been surprised about in your story was because I think people make an assumption, you know, insider trading, there must be millions of dollars involved in terms of personal gain. In your case, I think you said that it was something like $46,000 that you personally gained from. And so that has surprised a lot of people because there is minimal financial gain in return for throwing away a whole career.
In the insider trading, the average case is $58,000 US cases, right. But you think about somebody's career for $58,000 or $46,000. Steve, I never thought about the amount of money I was making, clearly, and I never thought about the idea of ever being caught, which may sound silly to people today, but at that time, it seemed like people were making millions. My first presentation was the rookie FBI agents, and they said, we learned in the FBI Academy, a financial fraudster does an analysis, should I take the risk of committing a crime based on the riches to be made?
Right.
I said, I know you guys are the experts, but I went through this, $46,000, and they said, it makes no sense, why'd you do it? I think I rationalized it. So it's usually not about the money. It's other situations with me. I was a very insecure young professional, not having the status others had, having the information. And once I received my first tip, I now felt part of that illicit in-group, where now I'm part of the group and I had the status. So just a very insecure professional at that time in my life.
Yeah. And I think probably your age had quite a lot to do with it, would you
say?
Yeah,
28 years old, 29 years old. I think my brain was fully developed at 25. So it's not an excuse, but that's like trying to make a name for myself, trying to show that I'm meaningful, that I have status. And I knew this information sharing was happening in the industry. I pictured as I'm looking through the clubhouse window, trying to see the secret handshake. And then one day, literally, when I speak to universities, I say the answers to the test fell in my lap.
Right.
You're just going to throw them away. You're going to look at them.
Very tempting, obviously. Coming back to companies, you've often said that tone and culture inside an organization matter more than any rule book. Bring it back to our industry, cybersecurity. How can cybersecurity and, more broadly, compliance leaders build cultures that discourage insider risk before it even starts?
It all goes back to the behaviors that get rewarded. So my definition of culture is the actual behaviors employees believe will be rewarded, will put them ahead. So often, culture is defined by companies as tone at the top, which is not the culture. Mm-hmm. That's just a signal. It's the actual behaviors that get rewarded. So I would encourage people in any role to think about, okay, our codes of conduct or our mission statements might say one thing, or we have three or four values. Every company has three or four values. Which of our values are true and which are not true and in what way? Too often we survey employees about the ethics, rate the culture of ethics. It's a Likert scale. It always comes out the same way. We actually have to ask better questions to which of our values are true, which are not. True or false, in this company, people who bend the rules get ahead. Anonymous survey, you're going to get more data that way to try to get at the actual issue inside the company. And just too much. We rest on the laurels of great shareholder letters from CEOs. It's not the actual culture.
Yeah. And I suppose one of the challenges that immediately jumps out there is how do you take a very large company, let's take a multinational, for instance. You've got multiple leadership teams, multiple different cultures going on, massive pressure, particularly in the financial services space, of course, to hit targets, hit numbers. How do you get that consistency of culture, of values, of ethics?
One company doesn't have the same culture, right? I speak at multinational companies, offices all over the world. In some countries, there's more of a deference to hierarchy. So they're not going to challenge leadership. You would not do that in, say, Asia when I speak there.
Yes.
So it's very, very tough. The leader has to set the right tone. We talked about speak up. Hey, wait, we have a values-based culture here. We don't have a rules-based culture. Mm. If there's not a rule, come talk to me. Sometimes compliance feels like if we have a bunch of rules, people are going to do the right thing. Actually, if there's not a rule there, will your employee do the ethical thing or not? Or will they start crossing lines because you can't have rules for everything? And so I think having that conversation, having a psychologically safe environment to raise issues and have discussions and be able to actually talk to leadership and have a different opinion about something, to be able to raise your voice, raise your opinion is important. I think too often when we say speak up, people feel like they have to be courageous when that's not what you're asking. Just, hey, as leaders, we have to be able to actually be able to take feedback and get back to people and have different viewpoints going on inside the company or even at the board level. I'll engage with boards. And I think sometimes the board gets the issue after it's already happened. How could we have seen this? I think at the board level, just one insight is to have, I call it a rotating devil's advocate. Mm-hmm. So actually have somebody in that role, because there's always so much consensus on boards that nobody actually has the role of devil's advocate. Right. So when they speak with boards, that's just one thing I encourage them to do, to have a rotating devil's advocate.
It's a good tip. I think the other challenge that I see is that you can spend a very long time building that level of trust. Mm-hmm. It only takes one thing to happen.
That's right.
Completely destroys it.
That's right. I quoted Warren Buffett today, lose money, I'll be understanding, lose reputation, I'll be worthless. His other quote is, it takes a lifetime to build a reputation and one decision to lose it. So you have that asymmetry. In my case, we talked about it was $46,000. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I wasn't thinking about the money at all. And if somebody had showed me, here's that iceberg underwater, here's that $46,000 above the water, but here's your career, your reputation, your livelihood underwater that you're not seeing. I think sometimes with risk, that sort of iceberg underwater is also a good thing for people to think about if you're trying to influence behavior, trying to influence leadership.
In your story in particular, rationalization, the, you know, I'm not really doing anything wrong mindset, played a really big role. How does that same mental process show up, do you think, in cybersecurity, where employees might justify risky behavior like data sharing or bypassing controls?
When we think about people crossing the line as bad actors, we think about nefarious or negligent. So I think it's actually more in the negligent, whereas what I mean by that, nefarious was my story. If people heard it willingly doing it, there's a cash payoff involved, criminal behavior, it escalated to that. Negligent, it might be an employee. Again, today's discussion about shadow AI, and everybody's trying to get their arms around that, an employee forwarding it to their Gmail, just using AI when it shouldn't be used, but you're more negligent than doing anything wrong. And I think that's where people can rationalize using it for whatever reason they do. And we see this, all companies see this. So I think that's, for me, where it's playing a bigger role today with shadow AI and that the use of those tools when they shouldn't be used for work.
I've always thought that, or I've always found that the more time we take explaining to people why certain controls are necessary, the better they understand it. And if you can, you need to make it personal. And then the light bulb goes on. People understand this is not just compliance for the sake of compliance. There are actually good reasons behind it.
Right.
And having that kind of discussion, you know, inviting that kind of challenge. I worked with one CISO some years ago now who told me that he measured his success by the amount of times that his policies were challenged, because that meant that people were actually taking the time to read them, think about them within the business context and what it meant for them individually.
Yeah. If you have a rule that a few people break, you have a people problem. If you have a rule that a lot of people are breaking, you have a rule problem. And so I think that's also to your point about, okay, what's being challenged? All right, what's not right here?
Financial compliance teams monitor trades. Cybersecurity teams monitor networks. But both are really trying to detect human behavior, you could say. What lessons do you think cybersecurity professionals can learn from how financial regulators track and interpret insider patterns?
Yeah, networks is interesting because my insider trading world was a network of information being shared to some extent. It is actually pretty applicable between finance and cyber.
Yeah.
I think a few things that they can do. One, just in that compliance role, whether it's cyber or not, you have to have a seat at the table with leadership. And I think sometimes in cybersecurity, you may feel this way too. Compliance often feels like a support function. When actually, no, as we're talking about, it's like a board level. It's something very important to the company. The CISO, the CCO, whoever it is, they are a C-suite executive and they have to have that status. And I think too often it's viewed as still as a support function when if you don't have the buy-in from leadership, your initiatives aren't going to get the full attention that they need in this area. So I think if I speak to a company and the chief compliance officer has to introduce themselves to the business, that's a problem where they don't have the respect that they have. And so I always tell compliance people, you're not just chief compliance officer, you're chief career protector. And that's a reframe. So to the extent CISOs can take something from that, hey, cybersecurity is not just cyber risk. We're talking about a real business risk. If you can translate it to leadership, your point about this is how it will impact you personally in the company, that gets them to wake up a little bit more than this is just a tech issue, which it's, boards are better, but it's still, we still have work to do, I think.
Yeah. One of the things, having worked in the financial services industry, one of the things that used to irritate me no end was the annual compliance test, if you like, that you had to go through, because it was out of context.
That's right.
The goal was to pass the test, right? So then you could carry on working.
Right, sure.
How you then went on from there was up to you because you didn't need to worry about it again for the next 12 months.
If there's annual training, and this might hurt me because I'm invited to speak at annual training, so I don't like it, but I don't want to hurt my speaking engagements. But to your point, anything that's annual training for thousands of people doesn't apply to those people. It doesn't apply to the one person because it's not for their specific role. And it's really, unfortunately, it's still checkbox. And I think we still have an issue with checkbox training, whereas my story introduces the personal consequences for crossing the line. But to the extent more people can do that and the training, that just makes more of an impact. But unfortunately, a lot of times it's watch a video or check this, as you said, and we'll do it again next year when you're just satisfying the regulatory requirement and actually trying to impact behavior.
Yeah. So introducing nudges.
Nudges, right, in this moment. getting pop-ups or that type of thing. All kind of the behavioral science research supports nudges and the use of that. So I'm a big fan of that, because you can have the annual training, but in the moment, I talked today a little bit about muscle memory, just having that muscle memory of actually what to do in that situation.
As organizations adopt more surveillance and data monitoring tools to prevent insider threats, how do you think leaders can strike a balance between trust and control, protecting the organization without undermining employee morale or privacy? Because I hear this a lot.
You want to steer clear of having a surveillance culture, right? So when the employee goes home, are they still at work? Are they at home? Are they still being surveilled? I will say there are stats that, you know, 1% of your people are always going to try to cross the line. 3% are sort of Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, but that middle 96% who we want to focus on. Mm-hmm. And so I think sometimes the surveillance is just focused on that 1%, which it's not really the majority of the company. And so you want to have systems in place. You have to for regulators and that type of thing, but you want to make sure that at the same time you have a culture, again, coming back to one of the big things I talk about today is that speak up culture, where if we see something, say something, where they're not just feeling like, okay, we're in a state of surveillance here with the Stasi or something being surveilled. Like, we want to actually have nice, strong psychological safety at the company. So that comes from leadership.
Yeah, it does. And it's a constant thing, isn't it?
It is. You know,
I really want people to understand that point. It's not do it once and then move on.
That's right.
It's every single interaction, pretty much, where you're creating that culture of trust, ethical behavior, and the reason why we exist.
And I mentioned today, rewarding transparency and not monetarily, just calling out somebody, hey, so-and-so actually raised an issue. We looked into it. It made a difference. And so just seeing, okay, it's okay to raise issues.
Absolutely. Tom, you know, your story is, I guess, ultimately one of accountability and redemption. What would you say to cybersecurity or risk leaders who want to prevent insider harm, not just through technology, but through human connection, empathy, and ethical leadership?
I think when you hire people, when you onboard people, everybody assumes, hopefully they want to do the right thing. They don't want to be in my situation. But I think with my story and other situations, you want people to have, I call it a healthy paranoia, that not to scare them, but that you could be one decision, as I talked about today, the difference between mistakes and bad decisions, you could be one decision away. Never feel like it couldn't be you. Just have a healthy paranoia when you're in situations, and not to feel like that could never be me crossing a line, because that's when we're most susceptible to that. So I think not instilling a scary culture, but just like this could happen in our company, these types of things. So just to have that awareness that it could be you. We're not above making one decision to go down the wrong path.
Tom, it's been great talking to you today, and thank you for sharing your story. People who are interested in hearing more, you've written a book.
Book's coming out in February, Wired on Wall Street through Wiley Publishing. That'll be out in a few months.
And available for pre-order now, I guess?
Available for pre-order on Amazon and all the places you buy books.
Fantastic.
The whole story's in there.
That's great. Tom Harding, thank you so much indeed for sharing your story.
Thank you, Steve. Pleasure.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more expert insights and thought-provoking discussions. But in the meantime, if you really enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate, review, and share the podcast. If you're interested in becoming an ISF member or continuing the conversation further, please do get in touch with me at steve.durbin@securityforum.org, or indeed get hold of me on LinkedIn. And remember, you can explore all our media and resources at our website, securityforum.org.